So a little bit of housekeeping type of stuff. I don't know if Canvas is all wonky in terms of getting your attendance and extra credit and stuff. And so someone from Canvas went into Canvas and started adding assignments, deleting them. And I don't know what you guys see, but I kept getting all these messages saying new assignment or class participation, not an assignment, all these things. The main thing that you need to worry about is that for the class, you get a total of 1,000 points is what you can get. And if you have extra credit, you know, say you have 10 points extra credit, and you can see it on Canvas, that's going to be 1 percentage point increase to your grade. So then, you know, you can look at how many extra credit points you have. And then attendance, basically, if you've, you know, attendance is a total of 50 points of your grade, so you can kind of estimate if I've made it to 75% of the classes, I'm going to get 75% of 50 points, so... Hopefully you guys won't. If you have questions about what your grade is, what I've been trying to do is make it so that you can look at your grade and be like, okay, how am I doing in the class? And just the way that Canvas is set up, they acknowledge that it's messed up, and so you might not know exactly what your grade is. A couple things in the news recently. I don't know if you guys saw the football game on Thursday night called, what was it, Nike Color Rush. So this was the Jets against the Bills. A fallout of this was that a recognition that 6% of the population is colorblind, and it's usually red-green colorblind. So this fits in with the ADA, the American with Disabilities Act. So basically, Deadspin did a remake of the football game, which showed what it would look like to someone who's colorblind, and... Basically, to someone who's colorblind, they just wouldn't be able to distinguish between the two different teams. And that play was kind of interesting because they were running it back, they fumbled, then another person picked it up, and they ran in the other direction. And the point to me that stands out with this is that the people who dreamed this up didn't have sufficient diversity on their planning team of someone that would recognize, hey, you know, actually, if we pick green and red... 6% of the population viewing audience is going to really struggle with this. And basically some of the Twitter feeds were that they just giving me a headache. I just couldn't even watch it because it was just too mind-numbing trying to figure out who's who and stuff. And so the idea is that one of the values of diversity is having people who can represent the various people in the population. And the other thing that's come up in the news is related to the attacks in Paris. And especially the U.S. response to it, in particular, 17 different governors have said that they do not... So President Obama said that they're going to be... that they've been admitting Syrian refugees to the U.S. And then 17 governors said, we don't want any of those refugees coming into our state. And Ted Cruz, Texas, said, we only want the Christian Syrians to come into our state. So we're going to do a religious test. And so you have this political backlash to the terrorist attacks, which is valid. I mean, people are not really sure how to respond, but it's crossing all these different social categories of being a refugee, being a foreign national, being someone of different religious background. And just like when we studied with the Japanese internment camps or the Italian internment camps, it's like, do you penalize an entire population, a subgroup of people, for a few people who did extremist activity? And so how do you navigate the diversity? And then the people, the Muslims in Paris, who are, I'll say, non-radical or non-extremist Muslims, are feeling tremendous pressure because of the attacks that were done in the name of Islam. And, I think about it also in the U.S., and it hasn't happened as recently, but there was a period where radical Christians would bomb abortion clinics. And it wasn't like we lumped all Christians into that category of the people who bombed abortion clinics, but we're much more inclined or much more quick to lump all Muslims into the category of, if you're Muslim, you must be radical or extremist. And part of it is we don't know many Muslims, whereas we know a lot of Christians, and so the non-radical Christians balance out the extremist or radical Christians. But when you don't know a population, when the population's foreign, it's just easy to say, well, they're representative of all different people within Islam. But today's focus is on class diversity, and it was interesting, even in the textbook, it's not a chapter. And so I had to go out and find something that would try and capture this idea of class diversity. And class has a very unique history in the U.S. in that we pride ourselves on being a classless society. So if you think of like India, which has the caste system, and when you're born into a certain caste, you can't emerge out of it. You're set in there for life. Or even in Europe, the feudal system or the hierarchy that existed in European countries was such that whatever class you were born into, you were kind of stuck there. In the U.S., it's different. There's this idea of economic mobility that doesn't matter what class you're born into, that you can always pull yourself up by your bootstraps and rise to upper middle class or whatever. And so we don't like to talk about class, or we don't think we have a caste system such that you're born into it and you're stuck, but actually there's a lot of mobility within that. But with class, what's interesting is that we can identify class pretty quickly. Like, we're able to point out, that person's lower class, or that person is of a different class. Like, they don't fit in. So even though we don't like to talk about class distinctions, we make decisions based off of these distinctions. So what I want you to do is to write down, just for yourself, an exercise of all the different class-based terms that you hear or that you find yourself using. So, you know, some of the simple ones would be like middle class or lower class, but there could also be colloquialisms like white trash or ghetto or other things, that just terms related to class that you use yourself or you hear people using to reference different people. Okay, what are some of the terms that you guys came up with?
I mean, of course, like upper, middle, and lower.
Redneck?
Educated,
yeah. Rural class.
Jersey,
yeah. The Jersey class. Another one might be like the working poor, or even the working class. So the idea is that there's different associations that we have with certain classes of people, but even understanding what class is can be complicated. And there's a general term of called classism. And classism is sort of systematic discrimination against different types of classes of people. And so just like racism or the other isms persist in society or in organizations, classism is another type of systematic discrimination amongst certain groups of people. There's many different ways that scholars have looked at class, and probably the most famous one is Karl Marx's theory of class. And how many of you have been exposed to Karl Marx's theory of class? So basically, the way that Karl Marx looked at society, he said his society is broken up into two different classes of people. You have the business owners, or the capitalists, and you have the employees, or the laborers, or the proletariat. And the basic idea was that the business owners would extract wages or capital from the employees. And the best way that I could think of it was my brother growing up. My older brother had a lawn mowing business, and he hired me to work for his lawn mowing business. He paid me $10 an hour. And so I would go out and mow lawns. So I'd mow one particular lawn, and it'd take me an hour to mow it, and I would get $10. But my brother would charge the homeowner $20. So the homeowner would pay my brother $20, and then my brother would then give me $10. And what he was doing was extracting the additional $10 from me. Like, it was sort of my labor was should have been earning $20, but instead my brother, the owner, got to keep the $10. And so he was extracting it from me. But the flip side of it is that my brother was wealthier than me, so he bought the capital. He bought the lawnmower, he bought the gas, he bought the oil, he did the marketing to go get the jobs. But the reason why there's this class divide is that $10 an hour I needed all of that to live off of. And so I wasn't in a position to save money because I needed my full $10, and so I spent it. Meanwhile, my brother he not only hired me, but he hired a bunch of neighbor kids. And so for every kid that was working, he was getting an extra $10 into his pocket. And so you can see where the business owner accumulates wealth, and then the labor class or the working class is stuck at the working class level. And in fact, the idea was, well, someone else, one of the neighbor kids said, I can mow this lawn in a half hour. So he was getting paid, in a sense, $5 to mow the lawn, and my brother was getting $15. So my brother was like, oh, well, I'm just going to only keep the people who can work, who are working really fast. And then we started getting mad at the neighbor kids who are working fast. We're like, hey, you're messing up our system here. You know, you're not playing by the laborer's rules. But what this does, and this is a very simplified version, but what it shows is you have the laborers are at the mercy of the business owners. And so if they were willing to get paid $10 an hour and work harder and faster, no matter how harder or faster they work, they weren't making any more money. They're still getting paid $10 an hour. But as productivity and efficiency increased, the capitalist, the business owner, would make more and more money. And so it created this class divide. There's a lot of complexities with Marxist theory of society, because now you have middle managers or people who are managing the laborers. So you have the business owners and you have the laborers, but then you have middle management, which, what are they? And Marx would probably say, if you're not the owner, then you're beholden to the owner. So even the managers are part of the labor class, because the work that they're doing is being extracted, some value from the work's being extracted and pushed up to the business owner. But the idea is that there's class divides, and class is, it's economic in many ways, but there's more to it than just the economics. And the way that a French sociologist Bourdieu described it, he talked about economic capital and cultural capital. And what he described was, and I'll show it up here. So if you look at this diagram, you have cultural capital positive is in this direction, economic capital positive is up in this direction. And so you could be a person, and this is the way that Bourdieu looked at different ways classes are perceived in society. So by just having a lot of economic capital gives you a certain class, but you could have low economic capital, but lots of high cultural capital, and so you would have positive class outcomes. And so the idea is that even if you don't have a lot of money, if you have a lot of culture, you can look higher class. Or in many ways, like when you come to the Indiana University, you have a certain level of cultural capital that you can pick up just by being here. Even if you come from a working class family, you could pass as being a higher class person, even though your economic status isn't as high as the other person. So some of the characteristics that stand out to me is people with high cultural capital and high economic capital, you know, the way they look at sugar, they use agave. People with high cultural capital and low economic capital, the in thing is cane sugar. And I guess you could probably expect that with people with low cultural capital and low economic capital, it's sweet and low. Or I guess it's stevia for the people with high economic capital, low cultural capital. But you can look at all the different categories of how we categorize each other, the things that are of particular value or the things that we promote. And the main thing with this is that there's just class differences. And some are economic based and some are culture based. And it influences how we interact with people in a situation. And in particular, at IU, and even more so at like elite universities, you have people coming in from very different class backgrounds and very different economic statuses, and they're sort of being asked to act a certain way to sort of fit in. So if you join a fraternity or sorority, there's a certain class that's associated with that fraternity or sorority or organization. And so you have to then sort of adopt those class characteristics and to fit in. Even though you might not have those economic, you might not have the money to do it, or you might not have traveled to Europe growing up, you need to catch up to speed to adopt the class of that organization. And the same would be in the workplace, that there's a certain organizational culture or class that they want you to adopt. And this gets into the concepts of assimilation versus integration. And this is one of the terms on the for the exam, is that assimilation is the idea that when you join the organization, we want you to adopt the class, the certain way of acting that is sort of representative of the organization. Whereas other theories out there would say, let's preserve the class of the people and let's have it be more of an integration where we don't expect you to change your language or to change your style. And if you think of class as style, can you think of ways that class manifests itself? Like either on campus, like we listed out the different class characteristics, but what are ways that if you were walking through campus or walking through Bloomington, what are ways that you could begin to identify, oh, this person is probably of this class? Like, what are some stylistic things that come to mind?
Like what brand of clothes they're wearing, like what backpack they're carrying and stuff.
Yep. So, yeah, that's right. You could think of it with, like there's the grunge class or the other like hipster class or the, so yeah, clothing would be a clear signal of the type of class.
The neighborhood that they live in.
Uh-huh. So yeah, you could even see, I mean, goodness, in Bloomington, especially with the public schools, you can tell what class people are just by very quickly when they tell you which part of Bloomington they live in.
A lot of the fancy sports cars you see driving.
Okay. So the types of cars that they drive, and that's an interesting thing, is that you could be someone who doesn't have high economic status, but you can pass as someone with high economic status by getting a fancy car and leasing it. It's a little bit harder to get a fancy house because you can't afford it, but then even small things like the clothes you wear, the tie, like what type of tie you have, is a quick way to enhance your class status at very little cost. You know, you can pose as being a higher class person based on like clothing or cars. What other stylistic things signal class?
Maybe where they eat.
Okay, yeah. Or even where you shop. If, you know, now Bloomington's going to get Whole Foods, and if you're of a higher class person, or Blooming Foods, I guess, would be the equivalent, but you know, if you go there versus the lower class grocery stores. Yeah.
For girls, a lot of times you can tell them, like, jewelry.
Uh-huh. Jewelry, yeah. Other things would be language, the colloquialisms or how you represent yourself, or even manners. I was thinking about this, like, if you go to someone's house for dinner and it's a wealthier family, like, there's certain manners or etiquette that go on and you're unclear of, like, you know you're out of place and you don't want to do something that is a faux pas of sorts. But that would actually happen with job interviews. I remember my very first job interview. This was very humiliating. I was going for an interview, on-campus interview, and I was like, oh, okay, I gotta get dressed up. But I didn't have a suit. And so I just threw on a sport coat and had khaki pants, and I think I put on a tie. But it was a blazer and khaki pants. And I go down to the interview, and the interview went more or less fine. But the interviewee at the very end, she said, hey, just, you know, a word of advice. You're applying for a professional job, and you should dress in a way that is representative of the type of job you're applying for. And it was just like a blow to me. I mean, I'm very thankful that she told me, but I was just like, you know, and I didn't look sloppy. I just wasn't dressed appropriately, and that hurt me in the interview. And so, you know, it's a common thing when you go to, let's say, conferences or other events outside of IU where you're no longer expected to be a student, but you're actually expected to be a professional. It's sometimes hard to switch out of that mode to, like, shave or to do all the things where you're supposed to adapt to the class or to the environment that's expected of you. So, like, if you show up to an interview with your suit on, but you have a backpack, you know, backpacks and suits don't go together. You know, you just don't do that. But you can see so many people, like at the Kelley School, walking around campus with their suits on. They look sharp, but then you see the backpack. And you're like, well, no, that's mixed messages. But it's because there's certain class-based expectations of what you're supposed, how you're supposed to act and how you're supposed to be. And so the challenge then for organizations is this a good practice? This all comes back to diversity, and is, you know, what this class as style and class as process and class as structure is sort of forcing homogeneity of, there's a certain class that everyone is expected to adopt within the organization. And is this a good thing? You know, it's just like any other level of diversity. Do you want to have people all become like you, speak the same language and do the same things, or do you want to preserve the diversity of perspectives? And so the thing with class differences, and I think for me, most of this comes out with nonprofit organizations or public sector organizations or social sector organizations where the client base is class diverse. And so I think of the value of having a variety of class backgrounds represented on your organization will help the organization to better meet the needs of the clients. And so one of the things that came out in the reading was that there's different styles. One is the working class style and one is the managerial style. And to me, the thing that stood out was the managerial style. When they're doing brainstorming or strategic planning, they talk about in these broad abstract concepts like leadership development and goal setting and mission, vision, values. And that's a very managerial style of leadership. Whereas the working class is much more concrete and practical, like my schedule and my pay. And what do we do when there's a mess or an accident in the workplace or something? Like just very practical, tangible things. And the idea is when you're talking about issues within the organization, it's usually the managerial level that's addressing all these different issues, and the working class just sort of go along with it. And so is there value in an organization by bringing in more of the working class people into the strategic planning and the organization of the company? But I think even more so when we talk about classes process, a couple of things that come to mind, like with a nonprofit organization, there was an organization that was in Indianapolis that wanted to set up a food and clothing distribution arrangement, and so they found a building to house everything out of, and they got it all built up and all renovated, and then they realized that a lot fewer people were coming to get the clothing and the food that they had expected. And when they began to ask people in the community, like, why aren't you coming here? And they said, well, you know, that building isn't located near public transportation. And the people, the altruistic people, the philanthropy type people who had set up, you know, rented this facility and got it all set up, every day when they would come, they would just drive in and there was a nice parking lot and they could, you know, access it very easily. But because there wasn't class diversity amongst their planning team, they didn't even think about the idea of picking a location that was accessible to public transportation. And yet, if they had someone, even just one person on the planning committee, who was someone of a lower class who took public transportation, that person would be able to say very quickly, like, by the way, it's really hard for me to get here. And if we're wanting to provide a service to people of a lower class, then we're going to need to pick a location that's more accessible to public transportation. Another example was a neighborhood association in my neighborhood in North Carolina where, you know, it was a very mixed income neighborhood, and it was one that was gentrifying, but there was a lot of people of different race and ethnicity, different classes, and we had a neighborhood association where we'd meet once a month to talk about the needs and concerns of the neighborhood, and we had an email listserv where we would just send out, you know, if there was crime or if there was different issues that came up. And after a while, one of the people had mentioned, hey, we used to do a newsletter where we would do a 8.5 by 11 newsletter that we'd hand out door to door to people. And most people in the neighborhood association meeting said, oh, why would we do that? That's so inefficient. We can just do email. You know, everyone's on email. And fortunately, we did have class diversity within the neighborhood association. And the person said, well, actually, a lot of people, like I think it was about 30% of the people didn't have regular internet access in this neighborhood. But for all the middle-class, educated people, it was like, what, 100% of people have internet access and check their email and stuff. So what we did was we shifted to passing out newsletters. And one of the benefits of that, which we found, was the actual act of going door-to-door and handing someone a newsletter and introducing myself and them introducing me actually made us a more cohesive neighborhood than when we had the old model of just sending out emails where it would go out and theoretically everyone would get it, but it didn't build community or cohesiveness. And so the value of having class diversity in the neighborhood association strengthened our community and strengthened its cohesiveness, because their idea actually, yes, it took a little bit more effort, but it actually accomplished greater ends of what we wanted for a neighborhood. And same thing with my kids' parent-teacher association. They would send out emails to all the parents, and then someone said, well, listen, not everyone's on email, and all of these emails are in English only. And so there's a class differences. There's higher class immigrants might be fluent in English, but lower class immigrants might not be as fluent in English. But it wasn't until we had people of that different classes saying, listen, it's great that you want to communicate with us, but we're missing it. We're not getting the information that we need because it's either not in our language or it's not in a medium that we can access. So I think a lot of times across the board, class diversity is something that's just dismissed or overlooked or ignored. But in reality, if you're part of an organization or a government where you're wanting to reach all the different classes, there's value and benefit of having representatives on your team that represent the lower classes. Because basically, in general, it's the lower classes that get overlooked or ignored, and then they don't get sort of brought into the full business model. A couple other examples that come to mind, I think of the YMCA, where the Y very much so wants to involve everyone in the community to become more healthy. And so some of the things that they're doing is simple things like childcare, providing childcare. So like if I'm a single parent and I want to exercise, in the past, you know, 24-hour fitness or the other places don't have childcare, so I just wouldn't exercise. But with the Y, recognizing, okay, there's single parents, and how can we encourage them to exercise? Well, let's have childcare so they can just come by, drop off their kid for free, and go exercise for an hour so that they can actually become more involved in what's going on in the community. But I guarantee you that was someone recognizing that people of different classes have different limitations that hold them back, and what are ways that we could design our program to be more inclusive of different classes. Those are some of the things that relate to the class diversity that I just wanted to at least cover.